time of the year. Karen, can you please call the roll call?
Debbie Berry.
Here.
Bruce Rinker.
Here.
Dan Moore.
Here.
Three members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
Please rise for the pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which stands one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Excellent. All right, our first agenda item is the presentation of the journal entry.
So pursuant to the bylaws, we every January, it's our organizational meeting, and so we'll swear in our commissioner. Commissioner Moore, if you want to stand up and raise your right hand. I, Dan T. Moore.
I, Dan T. Moore.
Do hereby swear.
Do hereby swear.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States of America.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States of America.
The Constitution of the State of Ohio.
The Constitution of the State of Ohio.
And that I will faithfully, honestly, and impartially discharge the duties.
That I will faithfully, honestly, and impartially discharge the duties.
As a member of the Board of Park Commissioners.
As a member of the Board of Park Commissioners.
Of the Cleveland Metropolitan Park District.
Of the Cleveland Metropolitan Park District.
This I promise to do as I shall swear unto God.
This I promise to do as I will swear unto God.
Excellent.
Thank you. No, I don't think I need to do that.
Suspicious moments.
All right, and as we continue with our organization, is there a motion to approve Bruce Rinker to serve as president, Dan T. Moore to serve as a vice president, Debbie Berry to serve as a vice president, Brian Zimmerman to serve as our CEO / secretary, and Wade Steen to serve as our chief financial officer?
So moved.
Was there a second?
On second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, excellent. And now our president will take over.
Moving right along. Next, we have the adoption of 2023 bylaws. Rose?
Yes, and you'll see as they start on page 34, the edits are not remarkable, just a little cleanup of grammar things here and there. Thank you, Ryan. So nothing really substantive in the update this year to our bylaws.
Do we have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Next, and again to Rose, defer to you, appointment of legal counsel.
Thank you. And we see again on the bottom of page one and the top of page two, we have the list. And as the bylaws require, every year we have an official appointment, a designation of attorneys who will serve and help us with these different areas as we need outside counsel's help. The selection was made based upon the RFP that was issued last year, which will be good for another 4 years. And so the fees remain the same as last year.
Very well. Do we have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
And then need a motion to approve, subject to any amendment, the minutes for our regular meeting of December 17th, 2022.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Turn to Mr. Steen, financial report.
Thank you, Mr. President. Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
Thank you. PowerPoint. Correct. You'll see on the first page, and we're looking at the entire year now, the year ended December 31, 2022, compared to December 31, 2021. The first item highlighted is the yellow box in the top. That's our real estate taxes. We are up 1.04% over the prior year. So I would just say 1%. I did, in preparing for today's meeting, look back at 2019, 20 and 21, because 2019 was pre-COVID. Our real estate taxes are up 2.28% compared to 2019. So you can see our revenues don't go up a lot. Once we pass a levy, it stays pretty steady. So when we estimate about a 1%, 1.5% increase per year for new construction, that's reasonable. But you're not going to get a lot of new revenue once you've locked your levy in. So we're up 1% over last year. The blue box, that's primarily driven by our grants. It's down almost 50%. We've talked about this at previous meetings. The primary reason it's down is in 2021, we received the American Rescue Plan Act money, the ARPA funds. We received portions of our Tiger grants, and we also received COVID-19 relief funds in 2021. Some drifted in 2022, but it's down primarily due to the grant revenues, not to gifts.
Wade, if you were to look at the last 5 years, what would you guess that would be? And 14 million is obviously an aberration.
14 million, and Commissioner, it's an interesting question because I did look back. That approximates what we were doing in 2019. It was about $12 million. Okay. So it's consistent. The 29.6 million was the aberration, having all of those Tiger grants and all of those ARPA funds coming in.
Thanks.
The orange box, charges for services, we're up 9.21%, and we're going to go through that in detail later. The 2.9 million is primarily driven by golf and our enterprise operation, so we'll look at those two in detail, but that's what drives the charges for services up. I've boxed in the operating expenses in yellow, salaries and benefits, contractual services and operations. Salaries and benefits is up approximately 8.7% for the organization. Contractual services, 9.92. And operations, up 19.42. When salaries and benefits, it's primarily staffing. It's not due to rates. It's just restoring staffing. We didn't see huge rate increases, but we saw a return to more normalized staffing. The operating expenses being up 19.4%. That's primarily inflation is the big driver. Increased quantities as return to normalized operations, and just the supply chain issues we've continued to talk about that drive expenses up. So all in all, when you get to the bottom, our operating subsidy as an organization, I like to point this out, is 33.4 million dollars. When you compare that to the 52, it looks low, primarily again because of the grants. But if you look back at 2019, this number was 30.8 million. So we've returned to 2019 levels. And I would say when you look at the organization as a whole, to have an operating surplus of $33 million, more than $33 million is very good given all the challenges that the organization faced in 2022. And now we'll go through some of the detail. The first one would be the zoo. Boxed in the yellow at the top is admissions, and admissions revenue is down 3.24%. I wanted to go back and say, what has our admissions revenue been in 2019? So when you look at our admissions revenue, it was almost 7.3 million compared to 7.5 million last year. But in 2019, it was 7 million. In 2020, it was 5.3 million. So we all know what happened. People couldn't go places. Then it bounced to 7.5 as there was a revival. 7.3 is what I would call it. And that's a very normalized level for us to run at about 7.3 million, 7.5 to 7.3 million. So though down slightly compared to 21, it was a very good year as far as admissions. The blue box we've talked about, that's due to the timing of the receipts of our Cleveland Zoological Society funds. That's why that is up this year 25% approximately.
Can I ask a question? Yep. You probably don't have numbers of people versus revenue at the zoo. I'm wondering if maybe that is also reflective of just more people joining the Zoo Society and so not, you know, paying every time they come in if those two things are split out.
I don't know off the top of my head, Commissioner. I know Dr. Kuhar is here, but I can't get an answer unless he does know.
We raised.
I'm just kind of wondering, people-wise, if we have a sense of are the numbers really down, or again, are maybe more people coming in that have an annual pass, and so they're not paying every time, so they're and their revenue's caught in a different part.
Yeah, so a little bit of both. While the attendance from 2022 was slightly lower than 21, it's still a very good year. I think the difference from a revenue perspective lies in the fact that a greater proportion of last year's attendance was school groups. school groups came back last year. So we saw a chunk more of that attendance number is reflected in school groups who don't pay at nearly the same level. So there is a little bit, it is a little bit.
So the numbers could still be really, really good. It's just the dollars are indifferent.
Yeah, it's just sort of shuffling around in categories from an attendance perspective.
Gotcha.
It would be nice to have the numbers, if that's possible.
We can.
Yeah, I mean, the revenue is obviously a good thing to track, but it's just interesting to see what the numbers are.
Commissioner, yeah, I can get with Dr. Kuhar and we can get that information to all of you.
Thanks.
Then the last item that I've highlighted is what I'd call the orangish colored box. And you can see that total revenues are up 2.76% over the prior year. Again, the primary driver was the Zoological Society, but I don't want to miss the fact that that's a positive, up almost $400,000 in total revenue. The zoo had a good year. When you look at our operating expenses, I didn't highlight it, but it's $1.9 million higher for all the reasons that 9.8% for all the reasons we've talked about. Return to normalized staffing, although the zoo did not see a decline in staffing as much as other areas other than in the seasonals. But a big driver was in the operating costs. Supply chain, inflation just really made it difficult, and the zoo did a wonderful job. This, I wanted to point this out. So we had an operating deficiency or subsidy of $6.4 million. To put that in context, that's a 30.3% subsidy. I mentioned last month we were at about a 27% subsidy, and I said I thought it would be about 30%. That's a 30% subsidy when I was told that the goal was always to have 50% or less subsidy. So that's a great improvement. And when I looked back at 2019, the subsidy was 36%. So when you put it all together, the zoo has reduced the amount of subsidy 6% while surviving COVID and having a very, very good year, even when costs were up.
Do we see it as a trend overall?
I see the subsidy continuing to go down. There's a point that it there will be some subsidy, as Dr. Kuhar pointed out, because schools come in for free and others. But 30% is an excellent performance. When your goal is 50 and you're at only a 30% subsidy, that's excellent.
And just to clarify, that 50 was almost a decade ago. And so, you know, that was the benchmark by which we were trying to get to because we were in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And so I think our sliding scale now, our new norm we'll talk about is in the 30s. So, you know, as we generate revenue, we put the revenue back into. So that was the original target. If you remember the original analysis we did as a board and a group, that was one of our goals, was to recover some more of our costs. And that was our original target. And now we've continued to enhance and surpass that.
Where do we see the yield coming? What strategies have paid off?
Well, I think there are a number of ways to look at how we've done in-park spending. I think our per caps on, you know, 1.3 million visitors, when you look at the addition of Wild Winter Lights, if you look at the Asian Lantern Festival, giraffe feeding, the Power Pass for the carousel, which the Zoo Society helped, the zip line. So all of the in-park spending certainly is part of it. There's a coefficient that's attached to the consumer price increase, which, you know, is essentially the zoo ticketing expense. They also are very focused on, I would say, their expense ratios as well. We've continued to, we bought a hay barn, which we had never done before. Our hay sat in semis and came in every 2 weeks. And so we were always at the fluctuation in the price. So now we can lock things in. So we've worked very hard at efficiencies. We've also negotiated a strong power buy from CPP at the time. So there were a lot of things that we did very strategically to help rebalance the math on the zoo.
And this really goes back to the adoption of metrics and ways to evaluate, set goals and then measure them and then keep refining.
Mm-hmm.
It's impressive. It's impressive. Thanks.
The last time I highlighted was just the brown colored box, the $1.4 million in construction expense. Again, we have talked about it, but that's the administration building. And if you haven't seen it, it's excellent. It's fabulous. But as Brian just pointed out, as we reduce that subsidy, you're seeing us make investments back in because $1.6 million in capital spend at the zoo is necessary as certain buildings, certain structures become a little bit dated. And the metric that you'd ask about, Commissioner, yeah, that is one that in working with Dr. Kuhar and the zoo staff, they are monitoring. That's how we'll measure. But all in all, as you look at this page and you compare the year 2022 to the last 3 years, the zoo had a very good year. Golf. So if we talk about Zoo having a very good year, then I think you'd have to say Golf had a great year. The top box, the yellow, you can see that just greens fees are up 12.7% year over year. And then when you look down at the pro, even though it's a smaller number, I didn't want this to get lost, even though it's only $67,000. That's an 80% increase in pro services. And that's credit to the golf director and the staff hiring the right pros who are giving lessons, who are driving revenue. And so, and that just increases interest in the game. That will then help drive this and drive equipment rentals and other things. So all in all, the Zoo, $1.13 million in revenue. That's 12.34% more revenue, total revenue this year than in 2021. And 2021 was a good year, so this has to be.
Did we have a record year last year of rounds?
We did have a record year of rounds.
So have we beat that record this year?
You know, Commissioner, I don't want to say we did or didn't. I would want to confer with the golf director to know exactly how many rounds.
I just remember last year was like incredible.
Yeah, I think it's going to be close. It's probably going to be down just a little bit. Okay. We lost, I would say, April, May, if I'm not mistaken. That was a fairly wet.
Weather-wise,
had those been in quotes normal,
yeah,
we probably would have been over. Joe, I think that's a correct statement, right?
Yeah, revenue up there, but Brownhouse a little lower because.
Got yep. It.
Okay. Thanks.
You can see that when we just talk about total expenses, they're up $1.25 million. The primary driver is salaries and benefits, which are up 18.7%. Again, this was mentioned, but just so we have it in the record, it's due primarily to the number of key positions not being filled for the entirety of 21, but they were filled for 22.
But also fuel prices were not $2.30, they were $5. And anything that's tied to fertilizer is done through fuel. So, you know, our inputs had a much higher valuation coming in.
And then the last item that I've highlighted here is construction expense is $651,000. You can see compared to what it was last year, we're making investments in our golf courses, the biggest investment. And you'll see on the detailed page is the $378,000 that's been spent at Manikiki. So far that contributed 58% of that total spend, but we are spending on capital and construction throughout the golf course inventory, but Manikiki got the biggest portion of that spend.
And that will continue with the maintenance facility, the irrigation system, and the upgrades that we're making out there.
And the goal, of course, for golf has been to break even, which it, in operations it did. And then the question of what we invest is our decision, you know, and that's, so I think this meets the objective beautifully. Remember before it was like a $3 million hole in the beginning.
Well, if the goal is to break even, these guys knocked it out of the park because they've got almost a $2.3 million surplus. When you look at revenues just over expenses before capital spend. So compliments to Joe, the operations staff, and the golf director. Golf just had a great year, had a great year. This is the individual golf courses. And I would just point out, highlighted in green is Little Met. That was the best performer of all the golf courses. Its operating surplus is 126% higher in 22 than 21. Washington Park, which this is supposed to be blue, but it's kind of coming out as a washed out blue. Operating performance is almost 56% higher in 22 than 21. We only had two courses that were lagging their 21 performance. And that would be Manikiki and Shawnee. But I want to make sure we point out when I say lagging, Manikiki had surplus of 513,000. This year it's 538. So a little bit behind last year, still positive performance, dropping over $400,000 to the bottom line. Shawnee, the same thing, 472. This year, 377. Again, dropping $377,000 to the bottom line. So they had positive years, just not as positive as the prior year. And as Commissioner Rinker had pointed out before, sometimes when you compare one year to just one year prior, you might have a good year, but it doesn't look good because you're comparing to a better year.
And here, I think in the numbers as well, that can be two rainy weekends can literally flip those numbers. So I think it's always, you know, that it can happen. I mean, on a rainy weekend, It can, you know, takes out the cart revenue, takes out the greens fees. It really has a dramatic impact. So it's one of those things that, you know, we're very mindful of, you know, paying attention to the numbers and how they, and that's, you know, again, that April, May was a really wet year. And if it was wetter on one side of town versus the other, because, you know, if you look at geographically, we're spread out pretty significantly, and the snow belt and the rain, you know, can be on one side and not the other. So some may overperform just based on that.
And the final, I want to raise up again, $2.3 million operating surplus. Prior to joining the Metro Parks, auditing local governments and being involved in that space, most municipalities, golf courses do not make money.
Oh, yeah.
Or they struggle to make money. So the fact that the performance is at that level is exceptional.
Yeah, it's no accident.
And then the last group is enterprise. You can see at the top, concession revenue is up 28.26%. That's the box in yellow. And that's primarily due to being back open again. We were open in 22. We were not open the entirety of 21. Our other revenues, and we're going to go through these in detail, are up almost 43%, $595,000. In the green box, operating expenses up $938,000, primarily due to salaries and benefits, which were up 21%. And if you think about it, as we closed restaurants, like, for example, Merwin's, and had less staff or no staff and then returned to staffing, that number is going to go up. But it's due to primarily their cost drivers, due primarily to return to normalized staffing. And then, as Brian had mentioned earlier, our operating costs are going up because of inflation and other things. So those two were double whammy. But again, I want to hit the bottom line, $256,000 in operating surplus compared to 96 last year. That is a very good year in the enterprise operation. In your enterprise space, you're still contributing to the bottom line. And we'll go through a little bit of detail now on, first off, Merwin's. I reported last month on Merwin's, it's the box in green, that they would have had to increase revenue 12.8% to break even based upon what we knew through 11 months. The good news is, now that we have a whole year, if Merwin's revenue goes up 6.4%, they break even. That's a very manageable, I think, expectation as the staff starts to work toward how do we find 6.4%, because then that gets you to a break even at Merwin's. I did point out East 55th. This is that was highlighted. No, it's not. This is where we see the effect of the boat dock rentals. We had talked about that previously a number of times when we went to the mobile app. Then the two star performers here are the Chalet, right there, up 59%. And then parking, we talk about it every month. The percentage, I had to calculate the percentage to look at it twice. It's up 265% over the prior year and just continues to perform extraordinarily well. And enterprise administration, the cost is up slightly, about 14%. Again, primarily due to staffing, due to operating costs, other things, nothing out of the ordinary when I looked at the individual operations for enterprise that caused concern. Enterprise had a very good year. The organization as a whole had a very good year. The last time I'd like to report that I didn't have a slide for, but on page 11, you usually see our investments. You would have noted that we had $56 million invested with Star Ohio, which is the state's investment pool, earning 5.13%. Just about a week ago, we moved $45 million to Key Bank and some laddered government securities, and the yield on that will be 4.76%. So we're picking up almost 50 basis points by partnering with Key, which, when I told Brian, when you calculate that out, that's about $240,000 of additional investment earnings that we're going to get by moving those monies to Key Bank.
Great.
Excellent. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian?
Good morning, everyone. And I want to thank the entire staff. You know, when you look at the years of 2020, 2021, 2022, and now we're into 23, obviously, you know, a huge kudos goes out to the entire operational staff that really made a lot of things happen, had to make a lot of pivots, and really, you know, did protect the taxpayers' dollars to the best of our ability. And I think when we continue to look at providing products and amenities that are complementary to the parks, we will continue to do those things, and we'll continue to be focused on our core value number one, our guest focus, you know, as it relates to what we do as a park district. So I just, you know, truly want to thank them for, you know, three really interesting years as we've gone through it. The numbers and the performance of the agency is really outstanding. So we will move into the first action item, the swearing of patrol officer, Chief Stillman. Bruce Arnaldo Torres, if you could please come forward.
Morning. Raise your right hand. Hey, Chief. I state your name.
I, Arnaldo Torres.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support the Constitution and laws of the United States of America.
That I will support the Constitution and laws of the United States of America.
The Constitution and laws of the state of Ohio.
The Constitution and laws of the state of Ohio.
And the rules and regulations of Cleveland Metro Parks.
And the rules and regulations of Cleveland Metro Parks.
And I will discharge the duties.
And I will discharge the duties.
Of the office of officer.
Of the office of officer.
To which I have been appointed.
To which I have been appointed.
To the best of my ability.
To the best of my ability.
I will faithfully carry out and implement.
I will faithfully carry out and implement.
The policies enunciated.
The policies enunciated.
And the instructions given to me.
And the instructions given to me.
By the Board of Park Commissioners.
By the Board of Park Commissioners.
Of the Cleveland Metropolitan Park District.
Of the Cleveland Metropolitan Park District.
This I promise to do.
This I promise to do.
As I shall answer unto God.
As I shall answer unto God.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You actually need to sign to make it all official.
I just want to thank the commissioners and Brian and Harold Harrison for allowing me to continually bring the most qualified personnel to the ranks of our great department to provide the security and safety of all of our park visitors. Arnaldo is he's not a rookie to law enforcement. He had a great career with the Cleveland Police Department, obtaining the rank of sergeant, officer in charge of the sex crimes unit. He's bilingual, speaks fluent Spanish. And he's going to be a great asset to our department, and we're extremely excited to bring him on board. So thank you so much.
You can introduce your guest if you'd like.
And with me is my lovely wife, Jessica Torres.
Good morning. Thank you and congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
The next action item is the 2023 budget adjustment number one.
Wait, don't we have to take an action on that?
We can do that first.
Okay.
Just making sure everybody's paying attention. Recommended action falls in the top portion of page 12, appointing Arnaldo Torres for a full-time police officer. Thank you for the assist.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Next, we will go to the 2023 budget adjustment number one.
Thank you, Brian. You'll see on page 12 a budget adjustment for over $13,173,676. That might be a little bit surprising since it's the first month of the year, but $12.9 million is for projects that were approved last year, capital projects, I should say. They were funded last year, but when we approved the budget in mid-December, we didn't know what stage they would be in. Now that the year is closed, we're rolling all of that money to the next year. Those projects are still ongoing, so I would ask for approval of budget adjustment number one for $13,173,676.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Very good. The next action item is the designation of the 2023 legislative consultant. As the Metro Parks has had before, all the way dating back to 2009, we've had a longstanding relationship with Capital Consulting. We continue to have biweekly and monthly conversations with our lobbyists downstate. I think really having a presence down there has been a really beneficial thing to the Cleveland Metro Parks as we've looked at various amendments and law changes that we've been successful with. We continue to look at our retirement systems and the cross-pollination between Fraternal Order of the Police and our current police. So we've got a number of items that we're still looking at. So we look forward to the recommendation on the top portion of page 14, appointing Capital Consulting for the 2023 year.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next item is a ratification of a single source 6720, 110 tasers, 7 certification units, 1 CEW Starter and an all-inclusive police program for training. This was a very unique opportunity at the end of the year to save almost $80,000 worth of taxpayer money by being able to do this. This is part of something that we have been doing. Tasers have been part of our program for a number of years. 17,500 law enforcement agencies use them. This is known as the best in the industry. So we look forward for the ratification of the Axon Enterprises Incorporated for a total of 376,772, top portion of page 15. And this is a 5-year agreement.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the authorization to submit grant application and commit funds. This is through the Outdoor Recreation Legacy Partnership Program. This is program funds designated for the urbanized areas as defined by the U.S. Census. This program is funded by the National Park Service, and in the state of Ohio, the program is administered through the ODNR. This is a preemptive opportunity that we are looking at in Forest Hill Park, in particularly in the East Cleveland area. Certainly, we have not concluded our transfer or conversations with the city of East Cleveland, but we are looking forward to being able to hit deadlines as money becomes available. And if we are successful in signing a long-term maintenance agreement with the city of East Cleveland, and we're successful with this project, we will bring in almost $2 million additional layered on top of the other $4 million that we've been able to receive. I do also want to thank the McGregor Foundation. They funded the complete assessment a number of years ago, and we really have looked at the A.D. Taylor priorities of park restoration. And so we're very pleased to be able to bring this action item forward as a preemptive opportunity on the top portion of page 16 as a recommended action.
Brian, can I understand that a little more? So now this would be $2 million, and we'd put $2 million of our own in. What other funds do you anticipate for that? The Forest City, Forest Hills is a big, big project.
Thank you. So there has, Rose and I spent time at the city of East Cleveland's public meetings through their city council. They have committed of their own funds, $2 million. We've also worked with Councilwoman Cheryl Stevens, and she put forth an amendment that was approved unanimously by Cuyahoga County Council for $2 million. So if we layer in the two plus two, Metro Parks commitment of two, this is an additional two that gets us to eight of about the $14 million. And then we've also, through Natalie's work in the development office, we have started to cultivate and receive private donations as well for Forest Hill Park. Now, again, these are all the preemptive things that we're doing. We're still working behind the scenes with the legal department and the mechanism by which we would work on that. So we are working very hard at laddering funds that can help for Forest Hill Park in East Cleveland.
And so the soft number is maybe ultimately maybe 12.
It could be somewhere in there. I mean, I think this is a very similar scenario dating back to 2013 when the Cleveland Metro Parks took over the lakefront parks. We were able to receive about $14 million of state capital. We probably doubled that amount of money across the number of years, and we continue to be additive through various grants, programs, Holden Park Trust with restrooms. So we will continue to look to leverage every dollar that we possibly can. But when you have a 50% match, we knew that we were going to put money in. We're also working with the Cuyahoga County Land Bank on a property demo, and our teams have been very diligent in that, and really what we could do to reimagine the original A.D. Taylor design of that park.
Fantastic. That's very creative, getting a lot of people to put their shoulder to the wheel on this.
This hasn't included other foundation support yet, so we're still in process.
Terrific.
And this is just so significant for a way for us to show future, you know, redevelopment, rejuvenation of neighborhoods. It's just so critical. It's essential. Being able to pull it off is going to be significant.
So the action item falls on the top portion of page 16.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next action item is Lakefront Reservation. This is an authorization to submit grant application and commit funds. This is through the Ohio Department of Natural Resources Office of Coastal Management. This is the Coastal Management Assistance Grant. This is in particular for about 400 feet, a 400 stretch of shoreline at Wendy Park. We have continued to see significant shoreline loss, erosion, We have looked at this, trying to figure out the best possible ways. We have worked on an approach with KS for this Riverfront Professional Design Service. We believe that a natural-based shoreline restoration can be really vetted well and actually hopefully significantly hold up to combat the erosion through this stretch of shoreline. This is an important habitat area for fish, birds, and other wildlife. We look forward to a 50% contribution on the Cleveland Metro Park side, adding and asking for $150,000 for a total grant submission of $300,000. So we are asking for an authorization on the top portion of page 17 to authorize a submittal of the grant application.
Brian, is that the part by the causeway that goes to the Coast Station?
It's actually not. It's actually the section that sits near the volleyball court. So we've got, I would call it an escarpment, where it's kind of eroding and undertowing.
Yeah.
So we need to redo that section.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next authorization of land acquisition, this is the Ironwood Golf Course Incorporated property. This is in Hinckley Reservation. This is 150 acres. This is from the diligent work of our real estate team, and including Stephanie Kutzko. This has been, I would say, one of the long-standing projects of Cleveland Metro Parks in the East Branch of the Rocky River. When the Greenway study was done back in 2003, the Metro Parks has supported many transactions, including the Hinckley Reservation of 3,081 acres. This continues to be a sensitive resource area within the corridor of the East Branch of the Rocky River. We have done work projects, you know, including Rising Valley and other additions in the particular area. This was a very good negotiation with the current ownership team to preserve this 150 plus acres in the East Branch of the Rocky River. And the following details are at least operating it for as a golf course for up to 10 plus years. It does have close proximity to Category 3 wetlands. Again, this will be, upon approval, the ninth golf course in the Cleveland Metro Parks portfolio. Recommended actions on the top portion of page 18.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Boy, upstream, downstream, and in between these last three.
I would say that, you know, this when you look at the significance of the outline on this property, and you look at what the Metro Parks has done in 105, will be 106 years, this is a truly impressive acquisition when you look at protecting headwater streams and the opportunity to influence the corridor. When you look at, I would say, most golf courses in private ownership, almost always have the same fate of a development or, you know, some sort of retail. Yeah. So for the board to approve this is a very big deal for the preservation and the continued preservation of streams and corridors and the enhancement of that. So we're very appreciative of the affirmation on that.
Yeah, it's kind of the talk about preemption. Yeah, it's nice.
The next is the tabulation of award and bids. The recommended action falls on the top portion of page 19 for the beautification project that the commissioners were briefed on most recently. When you look at the $1 billion worth of investment that the Metro Health has done, the investment that Cleveland Metro Parks continues to do in and around the Cleveland Metro Park Zoo, one of the great assets of Northeast Ohio, it is truly an opportunity to showcase a better entry point to those locations. This, again, is sponsored by NOPEC. The only thing that Cleveland Metro Parks did was add staff time to it. So that's a very positive. We also have bid number 6718, a negative travel marine forklift. This is one of the more expensive capital purchases we've done. However, we have operated Emerald Necklace for many decades with Cleveland Metro Park staff and with concessionaires. This current travel lift is very near its last opportunity. And when you look at the cost of boats and insurance, we want to make sure that we're continuing to provide a great service. We also have Trucks Student Conservation Association Corp. This is a single source. This is the work of Jim Rodstrom and Ralph Petrano bringing in an SCA crew. It's kind of a really unique way that Ralph originally got started in, and bringing that crew in with a dedicated group of individuals to continue to enhance our trail systems, and then a co-op for dump truck. So the tabulation of award bids is on the top portion of page 19.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Vouchers and payroll.
Thank you, Commissioners. At the top of page 32, you'll see Resolution 23-01-001 in the amount of $13,086,656.03 for the vouchers that we're asking approval for.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Public comments? Marty?
Good morning.
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 Even as you celebrate the increased visitors to Metro Parks, you must admit that more visitors means more folks at risk. It's certainly the case at Wallace Lake with drownings there the last 2 years. A recent plane dealer letter to the editor from the father of last fall's kayaking victim reminds us again of the tragedies. Liz Ruthenbush spoke here after the father and children drowned in 2021, laying out the special risks a quarry presents and requesting signage to warn the public. A story sign about the quarry was put up, but did not address the hazards. Sadly, Liz died last spring, or I'm sure she would be here today. You need to do more to prevent future fatalities. Depth buoys would be a warning and might also aid in locating victims. On-site rescue equipment for responders is needed. Perhaps life vests should be required for boaters. Most critical, though, is warning the public about how a quarry's sudden extreme cold water shock can kill. Failing to do so when you are aware of a special risk seems negligent. Aim to prevent disasters, but then also work to enable timely rescues, not merely recoveries. Meanwhile, back here on land, having recently committed to buying Fred Zepka's golf course for $3.5 million, you are now putting out another $3 million to buy Ironwood, plus agreeing to run it for 10 years. Much as I approve of land protection, that long period sounds like development at Ironwood was no more an immediate threat than it was at Hawthorne Valley. First meeting of the year, and the $1.2 million allocated for land is already overspent. Golf numbers, which boomed during COVID, are trending down again, so maybe it's not the best time to purchase and promise to run an additional course. The COVID golf bump might or might not last. If it turns down, then you may have overpaid, not to mention incurring management costs. I recall Metro Parks' optimism in years past about how golf was coming back. It would improve for a while, but then fell short again. Golfer participation rebounded nationally from pre-COVID lows, but numbers are still far cry from back in 2006. Better to be conservative and pleasantly surprised than the opposite. Thank you.
Marty, can I ask a question? The kayak accident, was that with no, without a safety vest?
As far as they know, there were operators on the kayak. He was fishing and apparently stood up. It was witnessed and neither the witnesses nor the rangers who arrived could be there in time.
Now, do we have a rule on I know there's a state rule, you have to have a life preserver on, I believe. So I would assume that the person may have just been violating that rule. Like when you rent a kayak, do you rent a safety, a life jacket with it, or is that?
The belief is that, and I can't speak to the specifics because I don't have the report in front of me, but the belief is this was an individual with their own kayak.
Yeah, hot day, chose not to wear the vest. Yeah, got it. Okay.
Not just for the families, ready both.
Well, but I think the key is that we have to have people wearing, conforming to the state law. And I know it's on a hot day when you're out kayaking, there's a temptation to take the damn vest off. But thank you.
Thank you very much. If that is the end of public comments, we will move into the. You weren't on the list, Lenny. So.
Oh, I'm not on your list.
Well, apparently not.
Come back next.
You have to come up to the microphone, Lenny.
Yep, thank you.
I don't have the advantage of knowing what the details are of this agenda item to hire Cuyahoga Greenway Partners to do a trail perception survey, but I would suggest that, to my knowledge, they have no expertise in doing surveys. And I would also suggest that because they're primarily funded by Metro Parks, it's not an arm's length survey. I'll give you a specific example. I think if you want real results, you hire someone else. They, in their early meetings, they suggested they wanted ideas for trails. Of course, I suggested that we complete phase three of the Red Line Greenway. But if you look at their maps, they refused to put that on their map. And I can't answer why. I have suspicions as to why. But what could be more important, of course, for me, that's going to connect 58,000 people to downtown Cleveland.
And was the third section, was that the part on the bridge?
Yes.
Okay.
So we've done phase one and phase two for $6 million. Phase three would be over the bridge, a short section, but expensive because you're going to probably need to bolt a trail on. It's been done in Pittsburgh and Portland and probably other places. But my point is that we should have, I think you should consider someone else for this survey if you want real results of what the public thinks about your trail's perception rather than Cuyahoga Greenway.
What would the cost of that? We estimated, Sean, is he? Sean, what would the cost of cantilevering over the bridge cost? I know it's, I've walked out there and it looks pretty complicated.
Yeah, come to the
mic. You have to come to the microphone. You're always on the list.
Yeah, you're going to be on the list now.
Good morning, commissioners. I wouldn't even want to bear to guess what the cost would be to cantilever that entire length. There is so much research that needs to go into that aggressive idea, which is really cool. RTA has said, we do not want to study that right now. Let's let phase one and phase two kind of mature. And then in the future, that could be further evaluated. The ballast still needs to be replaced on the viaduct. There are trackage rights for unused tracks that have federal aid on the viaduct that potentially one day could expire, and then the trail could be built potentially on the viaduct. But there's so many more facts and due diligence that need to be done. Just can't answer the question.
But completing that would be spectacular.
It would be
and it'd be nice to just have a rough idea of what the math might be.
Sounds like a donation opportunity.
I never said it was going to be easy. I did an estimate, it's outdated now, but it was $13.5 million. Pittsburgh did a longer section for $2.5 million. They built it off site, brought it in and bolted it on so they didn't have to shut the bridge down for a long period of time. So it's not going to be easy, but I mean, the fact that the point is that they wouldn't even put it on the map as a possibility.
Aren't we talking two different issues, though?
Well, I didn't mean to make that the issue. I just used it as an example of the lack of arm's length responses. They said, give us any idea, nothing's too crazy. Stephen Litt said that that would be Cleveland's High Line if we completed that section, as an example of how influential it would be. Meanwhile, there are other trails being built or being proposed, and not by Metro Parks per se, but that are probably equally expensive underneath the Lorraine Avenue or Detroit Superior Bridge, for example. I think that would be a cool project, but we can already get from point A to point B on a dedicated pedestrian lane on top of the bridge. So it doesn't really help us in terms of public transportation. It'd be cool, but it doesn't get people from here to there, whereas phase three of the Red Line connects the Stockyards, Clark Fulton, a number of underserved neighborhoods, and would connect them to the 120,000 jobs downtown Cleveland.
Would you be able to send us the $2.5 million Pittsburgh thing, just so we can understand if they had some creative solution that would be interesting for me at least. Would that be worthwhile?
Sure. No, I mean, we appreciate the point, but I suspect there's a lot more nuance to this as to policy decisions about utilization of that structure.
Yes.
I've negotiated with RTA for 5 years to get them to agree to build Redline Greenway in the first place, so that wasn't easy either.
Well, there you are.
Part of that trade-off was, and it was only verbal, that yes, you will do phase three if you let us put this, they wanted a dedicated maintenance line, which really cut down on the room for the Redline Greenway.
Yeah.
It was sort of a trade-off in those meetings. We've talked about all this a number of times. So it would, I think, believe it would be an RTA's benefit to actually do this as well.
The thing that jumped out at me is that concrete along the, you know, going towards heading east, the concrete was really crumbly. So if you're trying to hook onto something, that looked to me to be a little bit questionable.
Indiana Jones.
The viaduct was originally built for four trains. There's only two on it now.
Yeah.
So there, and one of the possibilities is actually move the tracks over and put it right on the viaduct instead of bolting. That's not cheap either. That's very expensive. They looked at moving the waterfront line, for example, and I think it was $23 million to make a small change in the water line.
I'd love to see what they did in Pittsburgh.
I'll try to get that for you.
That'd be interesting.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Next.
Anyone else? List or no list?
He was actually on the list.
Pardon?
He's actually on the list.
Well, there you are.
Hemlock Conservation at Cleveland Metro Parks. Jen Greiser is going to introduce our speaker.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to introduce Josh Phillips. He has been with us just over 5 years as our natural resource area manager for our East Side reservations, Acacia, North Chagrin, South Chagrin, the Euclid Creek as well. So he's going to talk to us about our efforts on hemlock conservation.
Good morning, commissioners.
Morning.
Morning.
I have the
You have to keep it away from something. But
so as Jen said, I'm here to kind of give you a view into our work doing hemlock conservation in the metro parks. So hemlock is a small but important component of our forest ecosystems here in the metro parks, mostly found in the eastern reservations, but also elsewhere. It is a keystone species. There are many other flora and fauna that rely on hemlock. It also shades and cools our streams and regulates stream temperatures in the hot summer months. And it also has aesthetic values. Some of our most scenic areas in the metro parks have hemlocks, and there is something really special about walking through a cool hemlock forest on a hot summer day. So this slide kind of shows the breakdown. North Chagrin has the most hemlock habitat out of any of our reservations, but Bedford is a close second. And then South Chagrin has around 60 acres of hemlock centered around the Chagrin River. Hemlock are also found in Euclid Creek along the gorge, Brecksville, Chippewa Creek Gorge, and then sporadically elsewhere. Unfortunately, there are some emerging threats to hemlock. Two insects in particular, elongate hemlock scale is a armored scale insect that feeds on the plant sap of the needles. It is native to Japan, and it can kill trees in 4 to 10 years and sooner with other stressors. It was first detected near Buttermilk Falls in 2018 in North Chagrin. And then we also have hemlock woolly adelgid, which is native to Asia, but also Western North America, where it hosts on Western hemlock. No ill effects because they co-evolve together. But it can also kill trees in 4 to 15 years and soon with other stressors. And that was first detected in this past year in North Chagrin near Ox Lane. And at the bottom of the slide, we have some different photos kind of showing how we classify the severity of our pests. So on the right, that is more of a severe infestation. So our response is obviously we wanted to stay ahead of these threats and kind of see how what the status of our hemlock forests were. So we began volunteer and staff surveys starting in 2015. We have an amazing group of volunteers. They have helped us tremendously over the years, and we wouldn't be where we are today in our understanding of our hemlock forest without them. Following up on that, in 2020-21, we did a much more intensive inventory of our hemlock forests. So in the survey, we're going out into hemlock stands in the wintertime. We're looking for these pests when they're visible, and we're randomly selecting trees and then surveying to see if the pest is present and the severity of the infestation. For the inventory, we're really diving deep, looking at the sizes of the trees, how dense the trees are, how many hemlock trees we have in a certain area, and then we're also looking at the tree's health. So, and you can see a view into the inventory at North Chagrin. We were finding a pretty significant amount of scale on a large number of trees, but we'll go more on that later. Jumping over to Bedford Reservation, in 2021, 140 acres were inventoried, and only one tree was found with the elongate hemlock scale. So this was pretty interesting that we were finding a lot over in North Chagrin, but very little in Bedford. Following up on that, in 2022, we did more surveying. We found slightly more scale, but still in very low levels. Going over to South Chagrin, it was fairly similar to what we were finding in Bedford. We were finding some scale, mostly in the northern part of the reservation along Sulphur Springs, and then also north of Miles Road near the river. And you can see, though, that 600 trees out of the total amount that we surveyed had no scale at all. So not so much of a problem. And then back to North Chagrin, you can see from this map, there are a lot of red dots, which indicate we were finding severe levels of scale. It was pretty consistently spread throughout the entire park. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we also found a small population of hemlock woolly adelgid near Ox Lane. So, as the Natural Resource Department, it's kind of our job to protect natural resources. How do we responsibly conserve and manage our hemlock forest going forward? So, over the past couple of years, we have developed our Natural Resource Value Index, which takes all kinds of different natural resource metrics into account and lets us know where our highest quality natural resource areas are in the park district. So using our data that we collected from surveys and from inventory and using the Natural Resource Value Index, we're able to determine where our hemlock forests were that were most important and should be managed. And then also a strategic opportunity came along with a Great Lakes Restoration Initiative grant for funding to do hemlock monitoring, treatment, and inventory with the Nature Conservancy. And then following up on that treatment, this past year we did effectiveness monitoring. It's very important in science to prove that what you're doing, what your management is actually working. So we wanted to go back and look at the trees that we were treating. And then additionally, we also did some seed collection to gather local genetic material from our hemlock trees. Maybe, you know, hemlock will be functionally extinct from the landscape one day, and we might want to reintroduce and do some replanting.
What is functionally extinct?
So, like American chestnut. American chestnut used to be a very common species, and now you really don't find it on the landscape anymore. There are efforts to do replanting of American chestnut now, so.
Replanting the same, different strain or just the same strain?
We would prefer to use our local genetics from the trees that are adapted to our environment versus getting them from somewhere else. So,
but they weren't very well adapted because they all died off.
That's true.
But it
sounds like a logic.
In the case of hemlocks, could you have a replanting program with Western hemlocks?
So that actually has been tried in Summit Metro Parks, and from my understanding, it didn't work very well. Western hemlock are adapted to kind of a Pacific maritime climate, which
wetter.
Obviously we don't have here.
Yeah.
See, they're different up there too.
So
they are different.
Josh, can I ask, how do these things transfer over long distances, like between reservations, or even some of the slides you showed seem like a pretty significant distance between?
Yeah, that is a very interesting question, and I'm not sure that anyone has a definitive answer. But birds, wind, and nursery trade, and also Christmas trees are a major component in how these pests have spread. So
thank you.
But I couldn't tell you why Bedford is so low and why North Chagrin is so bad. So it seems like it's moving eastward from the east to the west currently with the scale.
And does it die like in the wintertime at all, or is it just constantly recreating?
So both of these pests, they overwinter on the hemlock branches, and in the summertime they have crawlers that will disperse out into the environment
further.
Yeah.
And I saw this guy spraying here. What's he spraying with?
Yes, so that is an insecticide. It's a systemic insecticide, and that is what we're treating our hemlock trees with. That is called a basal bark application. So it's a very precise application, very little drift or exposure into the environment. And then we've also done trunk injections where we're really close to water. So we were able to treat, we targeted four areas up in Whispering Woods, near Hemlock Trail, A.B. Williams Woods, which is one of the best old growth forests in Northeast Ohio, and then Beecher's Brook in the southern part of the reservation. And then following up on that in 2022, we discovered that we had a hemlock woolly adelgid population, and so we added that area near Ox Lane. So we've treated over 600 trees at this point. And then, of course, we wanted to go back and look at these treatments to see if they were effective or not. And the picture on the left shows the new growth coming out, and then the picture on the right is later on in the season. You can see that this is a severely infested hemlock branch with this elongated hemlock scale. In the new growth, there is no colonization of scale. So pleased to say that over 50% of the trees that we treated had no colonization of scale, and the remaining trees, very little scale was colonizing. So that's overall, seems like our treatments were very effective.
And that was just bark, right? Not in injection.
Basal bark and trunk injection.
Oh, both.
Both.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know, I hate to make this comment, but there is a difference between North Chagrin and Bedford, and a lot of us know that Mayfield Village is all wet, and just a thought.
Wow.
but it is more moist.
Well, I have to beat out
it is a lot more moist in North Chagrin than it is in Bedford. I mean, it seems, at least riding there, it seems drier. No, I'm serious, though. I'll bet that's a difference.
Yeah, I can't speak to South Chagrin. You know, it's
yeah. Chagrin, be careful.
South Chagrin is not. The scale is not a problem there either, current.
I meant North Chagrin. Did I say South
Chagrin? You said
that. Yeah.
You made a point.
Well, thank you for having me today. Any more questions?
That was great. Good work.
Thank you, Josh. You know, I think it's
very encouraging.
I think what's great about the information items, it shows the real work that we're doing out on the field, and Josh's crews and the Tim Krynex and Valerie Carter Stones through Jen's leadership. I mean, they've done a really amazing job, and they're really paying attention. I mean, you know, when you see some of these, you know, I mean, the office here with the wormy chestnut, I mean, you know, those species, you know, they do go away, and they have gone away. And so our preservation of that is an extremely important. And when you look at, I mean, having traveled through those areas, those hemlocks are absolutely an important part of our ecosystem. So I appreciate their hard work. The next information item we have is the Cuyahoga County Greenway Partners Trail Perception Survey. We have a special guest with us this morning as well. It is.
That suggests all kinds of things.
Well, good morning. It's good to be back in front of you. It's been a little while. I'm Sarah Burns Meyer. I am a principal planner. And then we have with us today Macy Zalad. I'm going to introduce her. And I had to write out the name of her program because I never get it wrong. I do have this part right, though. She is a graduate of The Ohio State University. And her undergraduate degree is in environmental policy and decision making with a specialization in policy governance. And she is applying to graduate schools. going to be doing environmental policy work. And so she is interning with the Planning and Design Department for this year. She's taking kind of a gap year in between. So we're lucky to have her on board. And just wanted to introduce her. We're going to be doing the presentation together. But I'd like to take a moment and just address some of the comments that were made earlier. This survey is not any sort of contract with the Cuyahoga Greenway Partners. What we are doing is working with Cuyahoga Greenway Partners, which is an ad hoc group of entities that do work in the trail space in Northeast Ohio and Cuyahoga County to support trail development. And we've talked about doing a trail perception survey for several years. Commissioner Renker has brought it up in meetings multiple times, trying to get some local data. And so we were proceeding with part of the reason that Macy was hired for this year was to do this survey work. But instead of doing it just for Cleveland Metro Parks, the idea was to spread it out. We went to the Cuyahoga Greenway Partners. So members of Cuyahoga Greenway Partners include GCRTA, Cuyahoga County Planning Commission, were members of it, City of Cleveland, anyone that's really working in the trail space. The sewer district is also a member. So we expanded it to the Greenway Partners Act, asked if that would be something that they would want to do kind of more across the board, not just Cleveland Metro Park specific, to get data, trail perception data on trails that we don't manage, that we haven't built. And so that's where this expansion came from. And we'll run through that in the presentation. But it is not a statistically valid survey that's going to be conducted for something like that. We have hired out, like for our every 10 years, we do a statistically valid survey. This is not that. And we'll explain a little bit more what the survey is about. But just to make that point clear, there is no contract with Cuyahoga Greenway Partners. And we'll explain how the work is being done. But I will advance this. There we go. So I'm going to hand it off to Macy in just a moment, but just a little bit more background. Sorry, I keep moving back and forth. A little bit more background. We've looked at trail survey data through the course of doing work and planning for a number of years. In the 90s and early 2000s, there was more information about just overall safety of trails as the case was being made to communities. Yes, they can be safe, they can be designed well, they can be benefits. And then in the 2000s and more recent, up to the more recent history, it's been more of economic benefits of trails. It's kind of shifted over. The safety question's more or less been answered. So it's shifted into what are the economic benefits. There are big studies that were done, like the Rails to Trails that was up there before. The economic impacts of the Central Ohio Trails was a big study that was done for the Columbus area. But we don't really have any of those good data points for Northeast Ohio. And that's something that we've heard about a lot in public meetings. Yeah, you know, you have a study that talks about Miami Valley area, or you have Columbus area, but what about Northeast Ohio? So that's part of the impetus for getting that local data.
Sarah, can I ask one question? In by trails, do you mean paved trails?
Yes, we are focusing on paved trails for this perception study.
Okay, I see.
Yes, and that is, we're looking at paved trails, not even bike lanes, just paved trails. What's the impact been for that? What for the local communities? How have the nearby residents felt about them? Has there been any statistically significant changes in, you know, crime and any perceptions of safety? And so that's what this project, this survey is focusing on, is getting that local information so that when a community looks for, you know, that research, that information of how have they been received in Northeast Ohio, that we have that to point to.
Good.
And so Macy's going to take over now and tell you a little bit more about the work that she's going to be doing. So that one to advance.
Okay. As Sarah said, we're working with the Cuyahoga Greenways Partners on this project. And this survey was designed with the intention of providing the Cleveland Metro Parks and the Cuyahoga Greenway Partners with up-to-date and local evidence surrounding the impact that the introduction of new trails have on different aspects of communities, like quality of life, public safety, and property values.
So this is a map of the Cuyahoga Greenways network of trails, and we're going to be conducting our surveys across Cuyahoga County at different trails, such as the Shaker Median Trail, Mayfield Village Trails, and the Towpath Trail. So our final products of this project will include a video, infographics, and fact sheets that can easily be referenced by the public on the Cleveland Metro Parks website, and a detailed report surrounding the methodology and conclusions and inferences drawn from the results of this project. And these results will help us in the future in the construction of new trails. So there's two phases of this survey. The first survey will go out in late January and early February to real estate agents and police chiefs across the county. And then the second phase will go out to residents within 300 feet of new or existing trails in March.
300, you said?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And this will be accompanied by intercept surveys that will be conducted on different trails in the springtime. And we hope to have all these results and final products done this summer. Thank you.
Can I ask a question? If the crime is not a problem, to define whether crime is a problem, you need something very statistically tight. And if real estate values, I mean, no one wants to know that their taxes are going up. Is this the right focus to be focused on? I would think the perception of trails, do people enjoy them? You know, how much do they use them? I would think that things like that would be more important. And I would also think you'd want to include the unimproved trails, which are a part of the trail system. Some people don't like to walk on pavement.
Let me suggest that I'll answer that.
Okay.
I disagree.
Okay.
That's anecdotal. I think that, one, it's good to look at hardscape trails, paved trails, mm-hmm. because they take an investment. And the political decision-making always comes down to what's it going to cost? Why would we do it? What's it worth?
Yeah.
What's it going to achieve? And inevitably, people are, and we get this down in Columbus, we get it all over the place. People start raving about crime. And even though you throw those statistics, there's still this political push to drown out good data. It's like, don't let facts get in the way of a good opinion. I don't know how else you do it other than try to collect more good information about how trails can objectively and tangibly improve quality of life, and you measure those. And cost, benefit, safety, those things always come into play. Because councils, boards, whoever makes these decisions, people need to be convinced more than once, I think, that this is a good investment, that it yields results. And then you got to be able to track those data, collect them, and then start tracking them over time, because sometimes it's an imperceptible change, incremental. But I mean, look like that last picture. We kind of knew that if the Towpath Trail had an endpoint to the lake and you start pulling things, Red Line Greenway is another example, change happens. So look at the flats, look at Tremont, look at Ohio City, all these areas where people wouldn't even go in the daytime. And now they're being transformed. Is it solely because of trails? No, but are trails an integral component? I would say, yeah. I mean, look at those pictures. People are marketing. That's why you go to police and real estate.
Yeah. I mean, this is almost like opposition research in the sense that that what we're saying is the crime isn't bad. People within 300 feet like trails. I'm not sure that's true.
Well, and that's why we're
approximately. Yeah, it's whether they like or not. I think it's what ultimately can you prove is the change.
And that's why we're collecting this information and really focusing in, because it's at the public meetings when people are saying, well, how's this really going to affect me? We've talked to neighbors of trails. We've done kind of little snippets, little anecdotes, but we wanted to gather more information of really what is what's the local flavor of it? And that's why we're calling it a trail perception survey. We're not digging super deep into the technical details. There are other studies that have done that. So we're trying to get that information out of, this is how people are really using it. Maybe they were afraid of the trail going in at first, but now they use it on, you know, weekly or daily basis. Those are the types of things that we're trying to pull out.
That's accurate too.
Yeah. And that's, it is because a lot, you know, when we've gone and talked about building trails or when other communities have reached out to us, what's your experience? Do you have a study that shows something? And we don't, and we point them to these national or other regional studies. And so it's to provide that, you know, this is the Northeast Ohio local experience of a trail. And these are the people that we talk to. And the realtors and police chiefs, like we've reached out to police chiefs on other projects in the past. And it's same thing. It's anecdotal. Yeah, we haven't really seen anything. The only thing is sometimes there are people that fall off their bikes on the trail. And so there's maybe an increase in some injuries that happen because there's a trail
people
there now.
Use them.
Right. Exactly. That tends to be the kind of thing that we hear anecdotally, but we wanted to have some more of this information at the ready so it can be used by the Greenway partners and others. This is what we found in Northeast Ohio. And there are some other things in the works, like with a statewide trail economic benefit study that is, you know, being advocated for now that can get some more of the economic detail. We have our economic benefits of Cleveland Metro Park study. It's done through the Trust for Public Land. But this is more on perceptions. What's the lived experience of people around these trails?
Thanks.
I mean, we're seeing in Columbus even a push to take away powers of parks to make trails, to extend park amenities.
Yeah.
Because someone has this notion that it's not right. It's weird.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
That is the last info item. We do have no old business. The next regularly scheduled meeting is Thursday, February 16th. We do have an executive session. Rose?
Is there a motion to go into executive session for the purpose of discussing collective bargaining and personnel matter, specifically employment of a public employee?
So moved.
Second.
Roll call.
Bruce Rinker.
Yes.
Debbie Berry.
Yes.
Dan Moore.
Yes.
All right, thank you. We have no further business on which we will act. See you next time.
We're back.
So, do I have a motion to adjourn? We've undertaken no further business since we went into executive session, and I need a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.